The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield.
And this is Rick Durfee.
And I'm the CPA.
And I'm the lawyer. I don't know why that's funny, but it always is.
I know. Too bad one of us isn't just a CPA and a lawyer, and then we wouldn't have to go through that.
And then we wouldn't need each other. So
that's right. We'd just be able to do the show by ourselves. Anyway, we enjoy doing the show, and we just want you to know that you can reach us at www.whataboutwealth.com, or you can find us on YouTube. We're also at 480-324-8000, which is a phone number, sort of yesterday, but we enjoy phone calls as well.
I've actually called before, so I am impressed that somebody listening would actually write down a phone number and call. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. Well, we are, I'm really, interested in today's show and topic. It's been great to review, and I think it's going to be very interesting to our listeners, because a lot of our listeners are business owners, and many of them own businesses with partners, or even if it's with family members that are part of that that business. Our topic today, which is buy-sell agreements, is extremely important. And the thing that I was telling Rick as we were preparing for the show is that it's very important, but it's also extremely easy to screw up. And so because there are so many implications, both legal and tax. And so we're going to try to figure that all out today and how to walk through that minefield. But of course, we'd like to go into our first segment here, which is news that affects your wealth. And so Rick is the news guy. So Rick, take it away.
Okay. Really some interesting stuff. Clear back 100 days ago on May 17th, the Treasury Department issued a statement saying that the federal borrowing was just $25 million below the debt limit of $16.7 trillion, roughly. That's rounding some numbers here. And it has stayed there for 100 days and has just continued to stay there. And in fact, recently, the Treasury Secretary Jack Lew announced, hey, we're going to hit the debt limit here sometime in October, so which is yet out even further from us. And when that happens, the federal government's just going to run out of money. Oh, no. What are we going to do? And, of course, the White House has announced that the debt ceiling is not negotiable. The Congress just has to raise the debt ceiling limit and allow more borrowing without any kind of condition or restriction. There cannot be any cost or spending reduction whatsoever You just have to give them more power to borrow. Now, the bizarre thing is, you might ask, if we're not raising our debt, how are we getting the money to pay our bills? And there's a couple of things. One of the really amazing, astonishing things, actually, is what the Treasury Department has done to give themselves, quote unquote, headroom in order to create some cash for the federal government. And basically, this headroom amounts to what they do with all of these various funds that the federal government is holding. So typically, and most people don't know this, your Social Security and your Civil Service Retirement Fund and your Federal Employees Retirement System and something called the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Typically, what all of those things, all of those federally held funds do is they invest in treasury securities, which means that they loan the money to the government, so the government borrows from them. And so one of the things the federal government can do is, instead of loaning that money to itself, it can just spend the money flat out, which is an interesting thing, because a lot of people tend to think of those funds. We tend to think of our Social Security fund as a contribution we've made to a fund that's invested out there somewhere, and there's money in that fund, and so when we get ready to retire, we're going to draw on that fund and we're going to get our Social Security money. But in fact, the reality is the government collects that money and it spends it, and it just gets creative in its bookkeeping. So it's a shell game. Where's the money? We're going to move it here. We're going to invest in treasuries there. We're just going to spend it this place or that place. And so most of us taxpayers, you know, in this day and age of the most transparent White House executive branch ever, according to the promises of the politicians before they were elected, it's impossible for us to know what the heck they're doing with the money. The other thing they're doing, and we talked about this in previous shows, is they monetize the debt. They just print more. So it's kind of,
you know, Rick, it feels like you know, what we see, have seen some of our clients do in the past, thankfully not too many of them, but, you know, they realize they're in trouble and then they start borrowing on credit cards and moving money here and there and doing all this stuff. Then eventually it all caves in and, you know, they end up in bankruptcy or getting foreclosed or something. And it just feels like the government is just, you know, going down the same road. It's very,
yeah,
it's very unnerving.
I call it a personal Ponzi scheme. You know, a Ponzi scheme is one where you pay off old investors by getting new investors to put money in the deal, and there's never really any value in it. You just pay off the old guys by getting the new money from the new guys, and of course, you keep a bunch of the stuff in the middle. And I actually I've had this happen a number of times where clients come to me and they tell me, I've figured out a clever system. It's kind of like they figured out a system to beat the gambling odds in Vegas, but I figured out a clever system. I have 10 credit cards, and I'm going to borrow money on credit card number one, and I'm going to pay it off by borrowing on credit card number two and number three and number four, you know, clear up to 10. And I will have this bundle of cash, which I'm so clever, I'm going to go invest it in a way that will allow me to service all of the financing charges on these credit cards, and I'll make money. And I shake my head. What is it? So you're borrowing from yourself to pay yourself off, and you think that in the middle somewhere you're going to make enough money to cover all the interest charges. And yeah, it usually does end up in bankruptcy or very, very sad consequences. And the challenge is the creditors of the U.S. government, which are China, is number one. Historically, when government debts become uncollectible, it has resulted in war. That's probably that more than religion even has been the number one cause of war over the centuries. And who knows where it will lead?
Well, Rick, the other thing that and this is a CBS investigation has uncovered that government agencies at all levels are selling personal information to marketing companies.
You know, so, this is something we see all the junk mail we get, all these I actually have a client that's in the business of selling mailing lists. That's her business. And I ask her where she gets her mailing lists, and she gets them from the government. Voter registration rolls and things like that, or even people who set up new company entities, the Secretary of State's or the corporation commissions have found it's very lucrative to sell these mailing lists to direct marketing companies that will then send us junk mail.
Wow.
And it's a big business, and so this whole stuff of the government is tabulating our information and using it is not new. It's been going on a long time.
Wow. But doesn't happen, according to the president.
No. It's not. Oh, and you can trust us. You can trust us. don't worry. We're honest. That's what the politicians will say.
Right. So the quote of the week goes right along with this whole debt discussion that we've been having. And it's actually two Winston Churchill quotes. The first one is, "We contend that for a nation to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket and trying to lift himself up by the handle." I thought that was...
Oh, my goodness. That is a stunning visual metaphor.
Yeah, if you've ever tried that, you'll know why that's a good metaphor. And then my second one, which I couldn't resist throwing in, is, "The Americans will always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the alternatives." And that's what it feels like we're doing. So hopefully at some point we'll do the right thing regarding the debt and actually start trying to create an economy and some jobs and instead of taxing ourselves into prosperity. So,
well, you know, there was some economists, and I used to know their names, and somebody will probably let us know what their names are, but there was an economist back in the 50s actually won the Nobel Prize for predicting that the Soviet Socialist Republic of Russia would you know, the communist nation of Russia would fail and would collapse of its own inefficiencies. And stunningly, that prediction came true, and we did not have to defeat the Soviet Union militarily. Its own economic inefficiencies caused it to collapse. But the other half of that prediction was that after the Soviet Union collapses of its own inefficiencies, the West, and in particular the United States, would resume the socialist / communist experiment, and on the assumption that we can use all of the prosperity that our liberty has created to finance this social justice redistribution of wealth, and that we're rich enough and clever enough that we can make the failed economic strategies of the communists work in the United States. So it predicted that we would, in the U.S., adopt the policies and try to prop up failed economic policies with prosperity gained through liberty. So I think we're watching that unfold as we go here. And I don't think you have to be particularly conservative versus liberal to see that. I think that's just an intelligent perspective. Of course, all the people on the other side of that view see that as an extremist, reactionary plot. I don't know. They call it bad names because there's no way to refute the evidence and the intelligence of that idea. So let's jump into our topic today. We're going to be talking about these buy sell agreements, and I want to tell a story and introduce an idea of kind of how these have evolved. It used to be pretty common in days gone by. In fact, if you think back to the very famous story, A Christmas Carol, There's Mr. Scrooge and his business partner, Marley. And as we all know from the story, that they go into business, they are actually money lenders, and they're what we would today call a hard money lender. They would take a collateral for a loan with and they would have a high equity position, so that if the loan defaults, they're able to collect this collateral, and that's how they made money, and they became very wealthy doing that. But also, Mr. Scrooge tended to have a very skewed view of humanity as a bunch of deadbeats who would not repay their loans, so he had to go collect the collateral. And then Mr. Marley, of course, dies. And what happens to the business when Mr. Marley dies? And this is a little subtle nuance that is pretty significant. The answer is, because there was no legal structure or agreement to provide otherwise, Mr. Scrooge ended up owning the entire business. And so even though he, on the one hand, Mr. Marley comes back to him as a ghost, all trussed up in chains, talking about how the sins of his life had sent him into eternal bondage in the world after this one, Mr. Scrooge, nevertheless, was delighted in his partner's death because he inherited the entire business. And so the very first thing to contemplate is, if you have an informal partnership, if you're operating the type of business is called a sole proprietorship, and you're just, you know, you went into business with a partner, and you've pooled your money, and you're doing business together, there are, first of all, multiple catastrophic risks associated with that kind of structure that we can talk about. But one of the biggies is, if your partner dies, the surviving partner just owns it all. It's all theirs. So if your dead partner happened to have a spouse that happened to be relying upon that business income and happened to think that, gee, if my working spouse in the business, if something should happen to them, it's okay because I'll still own half the business. That is not true. The partner, the surviving partner in that kind of informal partnership, walks away with the business, and that's it. So the first thing we look at with buy-sell agreements, and in fact the simplest definition of a buy-sell agreement, is it is a written contractual succession plan for what is going to happen to a business upon any one of a number of so-called trigger events. And in this case, what happens with business owners and business partners is often, and two business partners, this used to be just the men, I hate to say, you know, in our society, but increasingly with a significant and growing number of women owned businesses, this is often women that are in this position now, we'll talk about it from the men's perspective because it's easy and historical, even though today it's not accurate. If two men, say two brothers, go into business together and they form a partnership with each other, and they're very successful and they're prosperous, and this is the question that a planner, a lawyer, or a financial planner, a CPA, or somebody walking through the process would ask them: if your brother died, do you want to be in business with your brother's wife? And I've asked that question a lot of times, and the question triggers an interesting response. Usually you will see a look of extreme anxiety on their face and say, look, I love my brother's wife. She's great. She's very good to my brother. But he married her. I didn't. I don't want to be in business with her. I certainly don't want her having access to the checkbook or yanking my chain or telling me how to run the business or what I can or can't do. So that's another issue. Even when you do have a corporate structure, and so you have a corporation or an LLC or a limited partnership or some kind of an entity that is going to own this thing, so we don't have that first problem, Death of a partner results in the surviving partner inheriting the business. We avoid that. But even then with the corporate structure, we have this situation of, well, who's going to be in charge? So we will pick up these issues and talk about how a buy-sell agreement is structured and why you want one and how it works and what the tax implications and landmines are. We'll talk about all that when we come back from break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. Again, this is Rich Bloomfield. I'm the CPA, and I'm hanging out with Rick, who's the attorney. And we're talking about buy-sell agreements. And these are really, really important. And so we hope that if you have questions, that you'll either call us or email us at info@whataboutwealth.com. We'd love to answer those questions while we're on the air here. But if you're listening to it and it's not live, then shoot them over anyway and we'll answer them on our next show. So, Rick, the you know, we've gotten through kind of why you need a buy-sell agreement, and I guess what I wanted to jump into a little bit here is kind of you know, what do you do? I know that I thought it was interesting as we discussed this that there are you call them the four D's that are triggering events. And so disability and death. And then, what's the other one? I know a deadbeat is one of them, but
disgruntlement and
disgruntlement.
Yeah. Yeah. And most lawyers, frankly, they only deal with death or disability. And those are the two most common and part of the reason for that is those are the two that you can insure against. So you can, and we'll talk about funding mechanisms in a minute here. But the triggering events is when are we going to pull the trigger and somebody's going to buy and somebody's going to sell, and those four D's. So if somebody dies, okay, we can't be in business with a dead guy, and we don't want to be in business with a dead person's spouse. And if they become disabled, you know, they probably can't work in the business, and we want to treat them with respect and enable them to have, you know, be empowered and have a great life. But you know, somebody in a wheelchair is not going to come and lift lumber all day long, or climb up on a roof and hammer nails. That's maybe a crude example in the construction world, disability often renders a person unable to continue in the business, so disability is a trigger. The third one, the disgruntlement, you know, sometimes, well, in fact, let's pick on my own profession. Yeah, often you're in a business partnership and it's not working. And in my own profession, in law firms, legal partnerships among lawyers, the average lifespan is right around 3.5 years. They don't last long. The people get in the partnership and it's uncomfortable sharing money. It's uncomfortable sharing decision-making processes. It's uncomfortable sharing staff. And especially when you get a bunch of prima donnas like lawyers all in the same room trying to be the boss, it just gets unworkable. And so legal partnerships tend to be short-lived. And the same is true in lots and lots of other segments, other kinds of business partnerships. So you need a mechanism. Okay, let's go into this. We're going to try it. We're going to do it. But what happens if it doesn't work? What happens if somebody just gets unhappy and decides, you know, I don't want to do this anymore? And then the deadbeat is a huge issue too. What happens if you go into this partnership and you each agree we're going to contribute, you know, this much work, and then over time you discover that one of the partners is just gone. He never shows up, or she never shows up, doesn't do their work. They've moved to another place, but they're still sucking the business dry. There's got to be a way to scrape off the deadbeat, and so all of those are triggering events, and there can be others that are business specific. I frankly had buy-sell agreements even between husband and wife that has a fifth deed divorce. We're going to be in this window covering business together, but they're kind of like a prenup. If we get divorced, this is how we're going to split it up.
And that's wow.
an ugly thing, but you know, to their credit, actually, I'm thinking of a very specific client that did that. They're still married. They've been a client now for 25 years, and they're doing fine. But part of it was because I think they were being honest and rational and very deliberate in their planning, and they were both investing heart and soul in this business, and they didn't want it to be ruined by one of them making some stupid marital decision. So I'm sure.
Now, one other one, Rick, that and it's not a D, but that I can think of. But, you know, just the plain old retirement of a partner, you know, somebody that's you've been a partner with. This happens, for example, in a dental practice. Or, you know, medical practice of some kind where you've got the dentist or the doctor and they bring in an associate and then eventually, you know, the older guy wants to retire.
Yeah.
So,
that's
you know, these. Pardon?
It's a departure.
A departure. We'll come up, there we go.
Come up with a D word for it. Yeah. It's a departure, which is a structured, orderly retirement. Yeah. They want an orderly step down. The old guy wants out and the young guy wants in. And so how do we order that so that it happens in a way that at the end of the day, everybody says, wow, I'm glad that happened.
Right. And the most difficult part of some of these where there isn't a death or disability is just the funding mechanism for making it happen. And so that's something that we will focus on as we go through this.
You know, I want to mention another one because this is kind of the disgruntlement, but I also call it the get out of dodge. You know, a partner comes and says, I'm okay being in this business, but I'm okay not being in this business. I just don't want to be your partner anymore. A provision that I include in my buy sell that I really like, I call it the shootout provision. Meet me at high noon on Main Street and the fastest draw gets to have the business and the slow draw gets to, you know, go their way, but it's not quite that dramatic. But, there's a mechanism for saying, okay, we want out, and part of it includes, the guy who wants out, sets a price and says, look, here's my price. I will sell my half to you at this price. Or I will buy your half from you at this price, either way. and the one guy gets to set the price, and then the other guy gets to pick. Okay, you set the price, I'll buy. I'll pay you that, or I'll sell. And so it's kind of like when I was a single man living with other single men, we would make a cake, and we would say, okay, we're going to cut the cake, and one cuts the cake, and the other guy gets to choose which piece he gets. So when you know the other guy's going to choose the piece of cake, you cut that cake as even as you can, because if you make one piece bigger, you know the other guy's going to pick it. So the same deal here with Shootout. If you know that he can sell to me or he can buy from me, you're going to set that price as fair as you possibly can. So that's another example. The Shootout provision is what I call it, a way to get out when you're disgruntled or when you just want to get out of Dodge.
Okay. I like that one. So, Rick, I think, you know, especially given our limited time here, we need to talk about the different methods of funding when we have one of these triggering events happen. Because as we've already alluded to, the funding can be quite different depending on what happens. So let's talk first about the most common funding mechanisms, because for death or disability, those are the easiest ones, but even those, I've seen people mess them up sort of badly, and I see it from the tax perspective, where you end up with them structuring it incorrectly, and then you end up with the proceeds that you intended to be able to be used to purchase the dead guy's interest being taxed, and sometimes even taxed twice because of the way it was set up. So let's talk through what can happen there, and how we can avoid the taxation problem and actually end up with the money that we thought we were going to get when somebody died to be able to buy out the business.
Yeah, well, so let's talk. The most obvious is the death, and that's death is something you can buy insurance for. Ironically, it's called life insurance, not death insurance. And you're not the event that triggers the payment of the benefit is not a life, it's a death. But anyway, death insurance is too morbid. Nobody would buy that. So in a buy-sell structure, you can say, okay, if one of us dies, we're going to buy a life insurance policy so that in the event of a death, there's this pot of cash here, and then we're going to use this cash to buy out the dead guy. And so in theory, the dead guy's family, be it a spouse or children or whoever the dead guy's family are, they're going to get the cash, and the survivor's going to get the business, which that sounds in concept, that's very elegant. It's straightforward. And it ought to work, but in practice, it gets really, really screwed up. And I'm going to go through kind of a worst case scenario, because I've actually seen this happen, and it just blows me away when this happens. So you have the classic business structure, which is the C corporation. That's the oldest, and even to this day, even though they're not used as much as they used to be, even to this day, it's still the most commonly occurring type of business structure, is a C corporation. And the two partners, they each own 50-50, 50% of the shares, and so they want to have a buy-sell agreement. And so they go and they have the corporation buy the life insurance. And they do this because they have the illusion that the corporation is able to deduct the premiums, and they can to a limited extent, but for the most part, the premiums are treated as a personal benefit. They don't know it. It's hidden in the deep dark mechanics of the tax returns, and you can correct me on this because I don't prepare tax returns, Rich, that's your job, but in the deep dark mechanics of the tax returns, somewhere, somehow, those shareholders are still paying taxes on that life insurance. But now you have corporate-owned life insurance, and then let's walk through the events. Somebody dies. One of the partners dies. The life insurance pays to the corporation. Now, instantly, this life insurance triggers corporate AMT, alternative minimum tax. So it has this big infusion of tax, of cash, but the corporation now is going to end up paying more income taxes. And then the value of the corporation is, of course, included in the taxable estate of the dead guy, the dead partner, and that value of that corporation is now greater. It is more because it includes the value of the life insurance. So, and in fact, the entire death benefit of the life insurance can be in the estate in addition to the value of the company. So now the dead guy has to pay an estate tax that includes the life insurance. So we get these double whammies. And so they thought, oh, we were going to have, you know, X number. We were going to have this much money to buy out the partner. And at the end of the day, because of all the tax consequences, they don't.
Right. And let me tell our listeners about one other one, which, and I think this was just kind of one that cropped up in a tax law in 2006. But it's called EOLI, which is employer-owned life insurance. And there's if when you purchase that insurance, there are certain things that you have to do, forms that you have to fill out, et cetera. And if you do that, then it doesn't become taxable. But if you fail to do that, and I've still seen this to this day, where this happens, and you don't take care of that correctly on the purchase of the policy, then what the law says is that automatically it's all taxable income.
Yeah.
And there might be a smidgen of it that isn't, but for the most part, the part that you haven't actually it's kind of like basis. If you for the premiums that you put in, you don't have to pay tax on that when you get it back, but the rest of it you do. So,
and it's not the entire premium; it's only the mortality charges on the premium.
Right.
So it creates a big, ugly, multiple tax consequences. And we can take this yet another step, and that is, well, what if there's more than two partners? What if there's five partners? And think about it: five partners. Now we have five sets of life insurance, and it just gets really, really ugly and stupid. And so one of the big things is your insurance should not be owned by the company. Do not have it owned by the company. So here's the, I guess, the kind of the second pitfall then. We have what's called cross purchase. Each of the partners will then buy the insurance on their other partners. And in the scenario where you have five partners, that means each one of the five partners has to buy four policies on the other four guys or the other four partners. So you have five times four, you end up with 20 life insurance policies on five people, which is ridiculous and hard to administer. And you're dealing with then, well, the old guy, the 65-year-old, is more expensive to insure than the 22-year-old. And how do you equalize all those issues? It becomes really, really sticky. Plus you have the problem of this company's now worth a gajillion dollars because they were very successful. And a partner dies and the insurance pays. And the survivors buy the company from the dead partner, but now the survivors own that company in their taxable estates. So when they die, ultimately, again, we're going to still have the estate tax issue, and now the estate tax has gone up by the value of the death benefit. So we're creating other unintended downstream tax consequences. Then also you have the issue of, well, what happens if one of the five guys wants to leave? And what if when he's gone, then you say, well, I don't need an insurance policy on him anymore, but it's worth something. So he says, well, okay, I'll buy the policies or I'll take the policies as my buyout for my share of the company, or I'll take them as compensation for my final service to the company, all of which triggers what's called a transfer of for value problem, where the insurance is conveyed in exchange for some value, and at which triggers, again, some tax problems, causing the death benefit to be taxable in some instances. So those are huge problems, and the solution actually is fairly simple. We can talk about the solution, I think, when we come back from break. We'll talk about how do we structure this complex buy-sell agreement so that we don't have all these nasty taxes that we're talking about. We can hit that after break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm a CPA. And, you know, I always, when I say that, I think, I wonder why I am a CPA, especially this time of year, because you know, September 15th, October 15th, April 15th, you know, just about every month, and then, you know, even other 15ths like January 15th, we have June 15th. There are all these middle of the month crises that we have to deal with, and whether it's estimated payments or whether it's filing deadlines. But anyway, so I'm in a death march right now towards September 15th. So if I sound a little scratchy, that's because I'm working way too many hours right now. But anyway, not to complain, Rick. We've got to carry on here. So before the break, we were going to talk about how to deal with these crazy funding mechanisms that we talked about without paying a whole bunch of tax. And so I know that that one of the best ways to do this is to set up a separate entity, typically an LLC, which would own a life insurance policy or policies on each of the owners. You gave the example earlier. If you have, you know, five guys, you're going to end up with, you know, 25 policies, which is ridiculous, as you pointed out. So if you set this up with a separate LLC, then you can just have that LLC buy a policy on each of the owners. And then by setting that up correctly and putting the right agreements in place, which you're going to tell us about, then we can end up with only 5 policies and no negative tax implications. So tell us how that specifically happens.
Well, first of all, let's talk about this LLC, which, by the way, the default taxation on an LLC is that it's taxed as a partnership. And that has some huge consequences for the ownership of life insurance. And with our 5 partners, now we have 5 policies instead of 20 or 25 policies. And now if somebody wants to leave, a partnership under the tax rules can distribute this life insurance policy to a partner, and that is not a transfer for value. So they can leave easily and inexpensively and take their life insurance policy with them without triggering unhappy tax consequences. But then we have another layer of issues to consider, because if the LLC that owns that life insurance policy is owned personally by the partner, we have inclusion of the life insurance policy in that owner's taxable estate. So they're going to end up giving a big chunk of the life insurance to the tax man when they die. And obviously, all this depends upon the size of the company and what else is going on in the asset accumulation of the partners. But in general, let's talk about the ultimate best owner of these life insurance policies should be a grantor defective irrevocable dynasty trust. Now, that's a mouthful, and that's a whole program in and of itself. But at the end of the day, we want this life insurance LLC owned outside the taxable estate by an irrevocable trust, you know, kind of a turbocharged, irrevocable life insurance trust, a turbocharged islet that owns the policy. And then on any one of these events, they split up, the life insurance on the guy that's leaving goes where? To his islet, so that it's out of his taxable estate. If he didn't leave, he died, then what gets bought out? His islet ends up with, again, the death benefit goes there, and his interest gets bought from him. And where do the other partners buy this company that's now worth buku bucks, you know, tens of millions of dollars? And the answer is they buy it through their grantor defective dynasty islet, so that newly acquired interest in the company is outside of their taxable estate, so they don't have to worry about gifting it and annual exclusions and crummy notices to their beneficiaries and all that stuff. We just automatically acquire that new interest in the company outside their taxable estates. Now, this is actually a very simple, very elegant structure. It's something that the better insurance companies, frankly, know about and teach about. But it's also something that lawyers, for whatever reason, have a great difficulty dealing with. And Rich, you and I actually had an experience with a lawyer that we were trying to get him to understand these simple concepts. An interesting lawyer that has 4 names, and they're all the same name. His first name and his last names are all the same. Anyway, interesting character. And he just could not. I don't want to say his name on the air. He's actually a good guy. Just he did not get this concept and resisted it and thwarted our efforts to implement it. And eventually, it in fact triggered some unhappy tax consequences for the parties involved. So
let's talk about it. And it's simple. Let's just say that we've got 2 partners, Rick. Even in that situation, this would be the best structure, correct? So
absolutely. Absolutely. You have a separate LLC, separate from the operating company. And by contract, they agree we're going to make payments from the company to this LLC, which means, by the way, that's a taxable distribution to these partners. So they're paying the premiums on the life insurance with after-tax dollars. Just deal with it. That's how it's going to be. But now We have avoided all those other taxes. We've avoided the corporate AMT. We've avoided the employer-owned life insurance. We've avoided inclusion in the taxable estate. All these other taxes we've avoided by paying for the premiums with after-tax dollars. So the by contract, the operating company makes payments to the insurance LLC, and the insurance LLC then buys the policies on the two partners. If they split up, they can and that LLC is in turn owned by their irrevocable Dynasty Grantor Defective Trust. And if they split up, they can each take their policies and go their separate way, no transfer for value rules. If one of them dies, the interest of the dead guy is purchased by the outside the taxable estate of the survivor, so that it goes to the survivor's family. But they continue to run the business, and life goes on, and they're able to pay themselves out of the business, and life is happy.
Okay. So that's the way to solve that problem. And believe me, any of you that are listening out there, that's a big problem. And unfortunately, most people are not onto it. And so most of the buy-sell agreements that I see or that we see that we haven't dealt with in our group ends up with some tax consequence because somebody didn't anticipate all of these issues. They're just using the same old boilerplate that they've been using. So very important to make sure that you get the right counsel on this, because at some point, and everybody says, well, when's it ever going to happen anyway? Unfortunately, with the five D's that we talked about, it can happen pretty often. Maybe not the tax consequences on some of them because the funding mechanism isn't there. But even the other things that we need to talk about here before we run out of time can cause issues. And Rick, I think maybe the most important thing for us to talk about for maybe the rest of the show is how do you value the business, because you don't know when one of these events is going to happen. And so there has to be some mechanism built in. And what I've seen in some of these agreements, Rick, is they just put in a static amount. So they say, well, the business is worth $10 million right now, so that's the value we're going to use. And then when the thing actually is triggered at some point, the business could be worth $50 million. It could be worth $5 million. But you're still stuck with that same amount. That's a big mistake. So
yeah,
how do we avoid that?
It is a big mistake. And I want to, as we segue into that, I want to just mention there's just as many tax issues on the disability side as there is on the life insurance side, but we're going to kind of gloss over that because we want to talk about these valuation issues. But the disability has its own complicated tax things. So when we're hitting this valuation, I think an intelligent plan has to anticipate the change in the value and then provide a mechanism for how we're going to accommodate that. And there can actually be a couple of mechanisms. Often it's very typical for buy-sell agreements to say, okay, we're going to revalue the business periodically, once a year, once every 5 years. And I've seen buy-sell agreements that require that, and then I've seen the partners not do it, which creates its own trouble. So even if the buy-sell agreement says we want to do that, I like to have a fallback mechanism, and that is some way of determining what the value is going to be. And in most industries, there's going to be a pretty standard way of figuring out a value on a business for example, that will be some multiple of earnings, some multiple of gross. There's going to be some formula that's industry specific that we can say, okay, if we don't have an agreement or we don't have a recent valuation, it can be that based on that formula. And then, of course, you can look at the book value, or you can do a present value on the earnings. Well, it's earning X each year, and so if we did a present value calculation of that, what kind of capital would it require to produce that yield on an assumed rate of return? You can also have discounts in that if you're leaving, you know, some of the other deeds, if you're leaving because of disgruntlement, you know, you just got tired of it and you walked away, or the deadbeat. Usually in the deadbeat rule, I have a discount of 100%. If you walk away and you leave, your interest is discounted to zero. We can buy you out for nothing, because you left. Darn it all, you should have stayed. You should have come and kept your deal. There's also the sale to a third party approach, which actually is a very good approach when it works. If there's a ready market for the particular business, and some professions or industries do have that, then we can say, you know, we're going to go find a third party buyer, and whatever they would pay, we'll pay. And that's another, by the way, exit that we want to anticipate. What happens if somebody says, "Gee, I found somebody who will buy my share, and they're willing to pay X." Well, do you give do the other owners have a first right of refusal or an option to acquire? That's kind of a mechanism that's built in there. And other factors that affect the value are, if you're not using some of these insurance vehicles, and it's going to be you're going to pay for the business out of the business earnings, that obviously is going to affect the valuation. So all these things play in.
Right. And unfortunately, as we usually do, we ran out of time on this, but what we hope you as the listeners have figured out in today's program is that buy-sell arrangements are extremely important if you're in business with somebody else. Make sure that you get one, and then make sure that it's done correctly. And we've discussed most of the difficult issues that come up. Make sure that you find somebody that can make sure those things are documented properly, that the agreement allows for all of those things to happen, so you don't end up paying a bunch of tax, and so that you actually have the money that you need to buy out the other partner, or that you anticipate other issues that can come up, which most buy-sell agreements don't. So call us, email us. We'd be happy to discuss any issues that you're thinking that you may have, and we will be back with another topic in a week from today on What About Wealth?
Thank you for listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.